This episode is brought to you by Rosetta Stone, the all-in-one language app. With Rosetta Stone, you'll have everything you need to learn a language and use it in the real world. They offer immersive lessons, writing prompts, and engaging activities to prepare you for real-life conversations. You can pick and choose the lessons that work best for you and create a personalized experience that's both fun and engaging. Get ready for life's adventures with 50% off for I Know Dino listeners at rosettastone.com/dino. Hello and welcome to I Know Dino. I'm Garrett.
And I'm Sabrina.
This week, in our 267th episode, we're wrapping up our Australia road trip with our penultimate stop, which was in Melbourne. We didn't do anything dinosaur related in Adelaide.
We did see a museum.
Yes, but I guess we didn't do an interview, is what I'm thinking. So for this episode, we have a bunch of dinosaur news, including a new dinosaur. We have a new Australian polar find to coincide with the end of our Australian road trip. And we have some new dinosaur attractions. We also have our last interview from Australia, which is with Tom Rich and Patricia Vickers-Rich that we did in Melbourne. And of course, we have dinosaur of the day, Melanorosaurus. But before we get into all of that, we want to thank some of our patrons. And this week, we'd like to thank Kyle, Brendan Kavanov, the Tolbert family, Remy Rodriguez, Rohan, Bradley, Bilal, Avery, Crispy, Albertosaurus, Trev, Ayrton and Everett, Greg, and Jared Copeland. And Jared just joined, so thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much. As always, we're always very grateful to our dinosaur enthusiast community, and we really enjoy chatting with everyone through our Patreon and our Discord. And if you're interested in joining this growing community of awesome people and checking out our rewards, then go to our page at patreon.com/inodino.
Yeah, as we said last week, we launched our ARC server, which is booming. We got some new structures popping up and lots of tamed dinosaurs. So if you play that game, definitely join us there. But without further ado, we're going to jump into the news section. So as always, we like to kick off with a new dinosaur when we can. And this one is really cool. There's a really good write-up in Scientific Reports where Oliver Rauhut and Diego Pohl wrote their official paper. There's also a good write-up in La Nación, which is like the local paper, I think, in Argentina. It was all in Spanish. I had to translate it. But there's some cool stuff in there that wasn't in the official paper. So this is actually a new dinosaur from December. As I mentioned last week, there's like a handful from last year that we didn't get around to yet, so I'm still playing catch-up. And Diego Pohl was actually the second author on the Patagotitan paper. So if you're familiar with that awesome dinosaur, if you've been to the AM&H recently and seen their quote-unquote Titanosaur, or if it's been renamed to the official name of Patagotitan, then you're familiar with some of his work in Argentina. And the pair also together named Pandora Venator in 2017, which is another theropod. It's about 150 million years old and was way less complete than this new dinosaur. The new dinosaur is an allosauroid and it's named Asphaltovenator. It's about 20 million years earlier, still in the Jurassic, so it's about 170 million years old. And its full name is Asphaltovenator vialidadi. Asphaltovenator comes from Cañadón Asfalto Formation plus Venator for hunter. And vialidadi is for, quote, the Administración de Vialidad Provincial of Chubut and the Dirección Nacional de Vialidad for their aid to paleontological expeditions, end quote. So two different things named Vialidad that helped them get the work done. It was originally found in 2002, and the province actually made a mile-long road to the bones so they could be extracted in 2007, which I think is partly why they named the species after them.
It makes sense. That's really helpful.
Yes. I think they said it was like completely impossible to get to. And there, they don't have a lot of helicopters usually to work with, so they had like a crane come out to lift up this huge block, and then they also just loaded it on the back of a truck. So without a road there, it's pretty hard to get a crane and a truck in. They took it out as a single block. It was almost Zool-sized, just a huge, massive block, filled up the whole bed of a truck. And it took 5 years until 2012 to prep out the really hard, troublesome rock. And then a few more years they spent comparing it to other theropods, then a couple years to publish. And then here we are in 2019, 2020, when we finally get to learn about it. So after all that work, they ended up with an almost entirely complete head, meaning both the skull and jaws, and, you know, full of teeth, of course. They also had lots of neck and back vertebrae, basically all the way up until right as it was getting to the hips. I think one of the vertebrae was fused probably to the sacrum, which is where the hips are. And then there isn't really anything farther back on the dinosaur than that. But in front of that, they did have lots of ribs. They have a complete arm and hand. They have pieces of the leg and foot. And then just one little tiny bit of the hips, which is the pubic boot, which is kind of in the front part of the hips. So a pretty excellent find. I mean, getting a full skull is always really awesome because it usually has a lot of diagnostic features, and that it's 170 million years old and we don't have a lot of stuff from that age makes it even cooler. Asphaltovenator's teeth especially are really interesting. From a distance, they look a lot like a typical curved, pointy theropod tooth, but when you look at them really closely, especially the front or premaxillary teeth look really unique. So their serrations specifically have really large serrations on the back of the teeth, but the front of the teeth have much smaller serrations, which usually they're pretty symmetric on the tooth. So it's pretty unique that they're asymmetric serrations. Obviously, the way it was cutting meant that one side of the tooth needed larger serrations than the other. The other obvious difference from Allosaurus is in its hands. Its third finger, basically the pinky finger equivalent, they're sort of like the Simpsons characters, their number of fingers, they're missing a finger, but their equivalent to the pinky is quite a bit skinnier and shorter than an Allosaurus. But otherwise, it's generally pretty Allosaurus-like, including the big brow ridges that it has that are almost like horns in some paleo art. Even though they look a lot smaller, they're kind of in the same place and sort of general orientation above the eyes. Like I said, it's somewhere around 170 million years old, putting it roughly 15 million years older than Allosaurus, or at least the oldest ones that you'd find in the Morrison Formation, since those are about 155 million years old. And they call it, quote, the most complete skeleton known from early Tetanuran history, which probably represents the oldest known representative of one of the main lineages, the Allosauroidea, end quote. So obviously a very important early Allosauroid, and the fact that it has this full skull to go along with it, which changes quite a bit in these early theropods, is really important. Diego Pohl also said that it's the largest predator of that time in the region, so likely an apex predator.
Those are always fun.
Yeah, which is basically what we thought in the Morrison Formation, that Allosaurus was probably an apex predator, but this is just the Southern American version of it. It's estimated to be about 8 meters or about 26 feet long, and that also puts it about the same size as an average Allosaurus, but we don't have any of its tail, so that length estimate is pretty approximate. You just don't know how many vertebrae there would have been in the tail, so you could easily add or subtract a meter depending on how long its tail was. They didn't mention its age or histology, so it could have still been growing potentially, maybe, or maybe it was a fully grown adult. I don't know. They didn't say. So maybe, you know, it would have been 10 meters long when it was a full adult. The sauropod Patagosaurus is from the same formation, and Patagosaurus is on display at the Bernardino Rivadavia Natural Sciences Argentine Museum in Buenos Aires, which is about 50 feet long, so really not all that big for a sauropod, but probably kind of big for Asphaltovenator to try to eat. But maybe, I don't know, it could have gone after it as an adult if it was desperate or something.
Could have scavenged.
Yeah, definitely. And it probably could have eaten living hatchlings and juveniles too, because they should be easy pickings by comparison. They also found a sauropod tibia, which was essentially in its grasp the way it fossilized, but it's sort of like in between its arms and its ribs. So it's unclear like if it was trying to eat it or what was happening. There's a slight chance that it choked on it trying to swallow it. More likely that it was just chewing on it, though, and died near it, or even some other meat eater was chewing on it and it happened to die next to it and get fossilized together.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to die.
Yeah, hugging your food.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Mid-chew.
Yeah. It's a pretty cool dinosaur, though. The idea that there was this sort of similar ecosystem going on thousands of miles apart in very different places, but, you know, you still had allosauroids, basically, and sauropods, pretty similar to the Morrison Formation, but way down south in Argentina. Hopefully they'll put it on display, too, since they have a museum that's been showing other stuff. Like, they also have Austroraptor in there, which is only about a 10-year-old find.
In other news, thanks to David who shared this one with us via Facebook. So Coffs Harbour Butterfly House in New South Wales, Australia has opened their dinosaur forest, and that's their butterfly house, and it's got dinosaurs everywhere. The exhibit is called Exiting Extinction, and they have dinosaur shows at 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. You can take photos with Trixie the Triceratops, and it looks like it's open through the school holidays, which I'm not sure how long those lasted, so possible that it is not going on anymore, but it sounds really cool.
Yeah, that's cool.
In Reno, Nevada in the U.S., you can go to Jurassic Empire, a dinosaur event that has more than 50 animatronic dinosaurs at the Reno Sparks Livestock Event Center, and that's on January 11th and 12th this weekend. So we're telling you this just in time if you're in the area. And last, in Cardiff, Wales, you can have a sleepover with Dippy the Diplodocus while he's visiting on Saturday, January 25th, so a little bit more of a heads up there. There's going to be workshops, hatching dinosaur eggs, and a film in the Grand Theater, as well as snacks, drinks, and breakfast. And then the next morning, if you're there, you can also see the Evolution of Wales Gallery.
Wales, W-A-L-E-S.
Right.
Not W-H-A-L-E-S.
Oh, good point. Good point for this audience.
Yes, because it's in Wales.
Yes.
But not in a whale. I've seen whale evolution exhibits that are really cool. Like we saw the one in Italy where they had a ton of whales lined up. That was awesome.
Yeah, that's true. So yes, can't be too careful about these things.
And then I have one more news item. Now that we're getting closer to the interview, which features Australia, I figured I'd save this one for last. We have some new polar dinosaur feathers from Australia, and two of the authors on it are the people we will be interviewing, but the lead author is Martin Kudrat, and then there's other co-authors as well. It was written in Gondwana Research, and the feathers that they're talking about were found southeast of Melbourne, where most of the dinosaur discoveries, at least the ones in Victoria, are found. And at the time that these feathered dinosaurs were around in the early Cretaceous, it was at about 70 degrees south, putting it well within the Antarctic Circle and officially polar, in quotes, because, you know, Antarctic or Arctic makes it polar. They found 10 feathers total, including everything from down-like body feathers to flight feathers, or at least flight-ish feathers, because they're asymmetric. And that's kind of the key to flight, is having these asymmetric feathers so that the air going over the top gives you the Bernoulli effect. Anyway, the range of these feathers is from 10 to 30 millimeters long, basically meaning that they're all under about an inch. So these aren't massive feathers coming from big dinosaurs. These are small insulation feathers, or maybe little feathers that might have helped with flying on a small bird kind of thing. That's what we're looking at. They also used some microscopes to check out how many melanosomes or other characteristics they could find. And they found what looked like eumelanosomes, or the black-colored melanosomes. And they appear pretty even across the feathers. So maybe they were evenly colored, but we're looking at individual feathers. We're not really looking at a full feathered dinosaur. So it's a little bit less useful for figuring out the kind of patterning on the bird itself, or dinosaur, I should say. They gave some interesting reasons, though, for it having dark-colored feathers. They gave the usual, you know, maybe it was used for signaling, you know, species recognition, or maybe for blending into the environment. But an interesting one we don't usually think about is maybe they use them to absorb more light and therefore heat in the cold Antarctic environment that they lived in. If you're interested in seeing these feathers, some of them are on display in the 600 million years exhibition at the Melbourne Museum. And Sabrina put together a video from the Melbourne Museum, and it includes a little bit of those, although we didn't probably zoom in enough that you can see the feathers themselves, but they're near the animatronic Quantasaurus and the Mutaburrasaurus if you've been to that museum.
And if you haven't and you're near the Melbourne area, we definitely recommend it. There's a lot to see there.
Yes. And that exhibit specifically, the 600 million years one, is probably the easiest thing to miss. When you go into the dinosaur hall, you have to turn right and kind of go behind it.
Right. It took us a couple tries.
The only reason we found it was because we knew it was there. They were like, make sure you don't miss the holotypes. And we went through a couple times before we finally found it. We saw the little Mutaburrasaurus head sticking up way in the background. And then we noticed where to go.
Yeah. Well, there's a few fun corners to go in that museum.
Yeah, when we were there, they also had an exhibit on like the gut microbiome that was really fun. Not dinosaur related, but really enjoyable nonetheless.
Yeah, that was a temporary one though. I don't know if that's still around.
It might not be, yeah.
But yeah, really nice museum, and the gift shop was really great too.
This episode is brought to you by Rosetta Stone, the all-in-one language app.
How many ways can you say dinosaur? There's dinosaur.
Dinosaurio.
Konglong.
Dinosauro.
Okay, it's not enough to be able to say one word in multiple languages, but it is a fun start. And it's the start of amazing adventures, which reminds me of when we got to travel to Italy. In addition to all of the delicious food, we had the chance to check out the Natural History Museum of the University of Pisa, which has some pretty cool dinosaurs on display, including a replica Carnotaurus, which is known for having arms shorter than T-Rex and horns on its head, and it's identical to the original found in Argentina. They also have a reconstruction of a Saltosaurus nesting plan, and Saltosaurus are those long-necked dinosaurs covered in armor, and a really special gallery that shows the evolution of whales.
Oh yeah, I love the whale evolution. Yeah, we rented a car to go to the museum, and it helped to know some Italian to navigate around Italy, not surprisingly.
Mm-hmm.
I've been studying Italian for a little bit now, and it's a wonderful language. One of the coolest things about it is it's the modern version of Latin. So with dinosaur names, a lot of times the words are already familiar.
Not just the names, but like parts of dinosaurs.
Very true.
So enter Rosetta Stone. Learning languages really opens up the possibilities for adventure. And Rosetta Stone has been the expert in language learning for 30 years. It's designed so you can learn languages in an intuitive way and you remember your skills long term. And it ensures that you can pronounce each word.
And the best part is if you join now at rosettastone.com/dino, there's a special offer just for our listeners. And you can get more than 50% off lifetime access to 25 language courses. Again, that's rosettastone.com/dino, D-I-N-O.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
And now we're going to go on to our interview with Tom and Pat. We're joined today by Tom Rich, who's at the Museums Victoria in Melbourne and an affiliate at Monash University and Swinburne University of Technology, also in Melbourne, and Pat Vickers Rich, who's also at the Monash University and Swinburne University of Technology.
Yep. And they've been kind enough to invite us to their homes and give us tea and cookies.
We've got to lure you here somehow.
We really appreciate it.
Yeah.
And we do too. To have your interest.
So I kind of want to start at the beginning, if that's okay, because you guys have been working in this area for such a long time. And I know you've discovered so many dinosaurs, but what was the early process like when you were working in the area?
Well, we began by, I got a job in 1974. And initially what we were trying to do was to find older mammals, the ones that have been found, because it was really fossil mammals that got me interested. And at the time, only the last 10% of mammalian history was documented well on this continent for the terrestrial mammals. So I was interested in the first 90%. So what we did was we went to the area where our predecessor had had success up in northern South Australia, because he had found progressively older sites there. And I thought, well, we'll keep going back. So we spent about the first 5 years trying to figure out where we're going to work. Well, little did we know that in our backyard, within 200 kilometers where we're sitting here in eastern Melbourne, was where we should have started. But we had to find that out. And so finally, what happened was that two students went to the site where one dinosaur bone had been found in 1903, and then nothing more for the next 75 years. It was 1978. And they returned to the site, and within about 5 minutes, one of them found a single block of rock with one bone in it. So this was a second one. And they had the visual set of what they were looking for, because one of the problems with trying to find fossils, where eventually we found a lot of them, was that they were in an unexpected occurrence. People just weren't used to looking, including us, looking for bones preserved in just this way. Mm-hmm. The bones are basically seen as typically cross-sections. Rather than seeing something that looks like a bone, you just see a random cross-section, typically black or dark brown. And you have to look at the structure of them, the microstructure, to detect them as bone. Because the problem is, for every one of those bones, there's 10,000 pieces of coal that look just like them.
Wow.
So it takes a while to get the right mindset to know what you're looking for. Once we had that, we looked at the geological map of the state and realized that along the coast, for about 150 kilometers east and west of Melbourne, was the right kind of rock. And so we started prospecting that systematically. And eventually we found a number of fossil sites that we then exploited. But I'm compressing this story into about 10 years. And finally, in 1984, we had a test dig at a locality that became known as Dinosaur Cove. And there we... On the first dig, I had 70 volunteers aged 7 to 77 who were eager to find dinosaurs, and we managed to dig an area underground about the size of two telephone booths, and out of it came 80 bones, and I realized we could do it, but it meant we were going to have to tunnel. I didn't want to learn about tunneling, but I had to, and so we did. And so we actually drove tunnels, and we started finding a regular supply of dinosaurs. So what was made these dinosaurs particularly interesting, because they were the virtually the only ones known from southeastern Australia, but they were also polar. So that added another component of interest to them. So we kept digging them, hoping we'd find mammals and birds along with them. Eventually we did, but very few. So it mainly was dinosaurs that drove the whole project. And in doing that, we attracted a lot of volunteers, and over the past 40 years, about 700 people have helped us out.
Wow.
And there's a group of them that keep coming back every year, and they are critical in making the whole thing happen. And two of them went out, and they found the second site that we've worked. We spent 20 years at a second site, which is almost 200 kilometers east of Dinosaur Cove. And from there is actually where we got most of the mammals, which were what I was really interested in the first place. But along the way, we've found some more dinosaurs. So we've named about five dinosaurs from southeastern Australia. And probably they'll be valid. We probably won't have a case of the Apatosaurus brontosaurus problem that you might be aware of, because simply we found the first ones. And we're trying, to extend our knowledge of them, because most of these are found from just single bones or teeth, and they're not whole skeletons for the most part. So we know just enough about them to put names on them that are probably valid, but we know most of what they look like because we can tie them into skeletons known on other continents. And that's critical, because if our dinosaurs were as uniquely Australian as the current mammals are, the koalas, wombats, and kangaroos, we'd have almost no idea what they look like because we just have bits and pieces. But because we can slot them in to dinosaurs known elsewhere, we got a pretty good idea. And in a few cases where we've actually found a partial skeleton, we haven't been surprised by finding, oh, it's quite different from what we would have expected.
And speaking of dinosaurs or animals that you've named two after your kids, right?
Yes. What happened was that Pat was in China in 1979, and I was prospecting the coast looking for fossils. And she was being taken care of by a lady who worked with us during the day, and then at night I'd come home. And she was a pretty cluey 2.5-year-old, and she realized that Daddy was looking for fossils, dinosaurs, and that she had a book called My Little Dinosaur. It was about a little boy who finds a living dinosaur and takes it home for a pet. And so putting two and two together with the impeccable logic of a 2.5-year-old, she says, why can't I have one? She says, Daddy, can I have a dinosaur? And I said, well, actually, I can't really get you a living one. But if I ever find a, if I ever find one that's new, I'll name it for you. She had to wait 10 years, but she got it. And that's the basis of the name Leonosaura. And then she had a brother.
Now, you didn't tell the finished story. When you did name it after, she said, I wanted a live one. As a joke.
Anyway, her brother had to have one too. So we fortunately found another one that was renamed for him, Tamimus, which at the time we named it, we thought it was an Ornithomimosaur. But then more material of it turned up, and it turns out to be some sort of a relationship to a Tyrannosauroid. Mm. So she called up, her son called our daughter and said, now I can eat you because I've got teeth.
But a little bit more to that story is that it's the name is shared between Tim and his godless father, Tim Flannery, who was the one that started finding, along with his cousin, John Long, started finding the bones along that coast.
Of the three sites, major sites we've worked, it was the most daunting of the three. I mean, I never would have worked Dinosaur Cove if we'd known of the other two. Mm-hmm. But at the time when we started Dinosaur Cove, that was the only place we could possibly work. So that's where we started.
Gotcha.
But it led to the other sites.
Is one of the other sites the Eric the
Eric
Red?
Eric the Red West, yeah.
What's the name behind that story?
Okay.
The story behind the name.
There was a sailing ship called Eric the Red, which left New York in 1880, bringing a gear for an international exhibition here in Melbourne. And something like 80 days out, it was going around Cape Otway, and it got a little bit too close, and it crashed into the rocks. And so the anchor of Eric the Red West was recovered and is actually on the beach about 175 meters east of Eric the Red West. And the reason we call it Eric the Red West is because there's a site called Eric the Red right at the anchor. So what happened was in 2005, a partial skeleton was found at what became Eric the Red West. I'm hoping we'll find more of it, because the problem with that skeleton is it's a postcranial. It's the basis for the name Dilubi cursor, mm-hmm. but we can't relate it to the other dinosaurs that we found, because all the other ones have been named on the basis of dentitions. So what we kept hoping was, oh, you found this partial skeleton, there must be another one. Well, we've spent 12 seasons there and we haven't found another partial skeleton. We're going to have a dig in early November for just 5 days, because what happened was at the penultimate day of the last dig there in 2017, we found a clump of rock about, we're talking American, okay, about a foot across, which had 15 bones in it of both groups of dinosaurs and a turtle.
Wow.
And I've never seen a concentration like that in 40 years on the coast of Victoria. So we're going to go back and see if that's the beginning of a rich concentration there. Now, if it is, possibly we might come up with a partial skeleton of another dinosaur, maybe of Dilubi cursor, mm-hmm. and find out if Dilubi cursor maybe is actually another name for Atlas Copcosaurus, because teeth of Atlas Copcosaurus are abundant at that site. Mm. And there's other ornithopods at that site. So it could be that's what it is. So it could be that Dilubi cursor is a junior synonym of Atlas Copcosaurus, but we can't tell, because we're comparing apples and oranges. We're comparing a dentition to a postcranial skeleton. We just don't know.
Well, the good news is that Leonosaura and Tamimus are not threatened
to be
junior synonyms.
No, those two are pretty distinct, as well as Quantosaurus, the other ornithopod. They're distinct from each other. There's no doubt about that. Whether they have any relationship to Dilubi cursor or even Galeonosaurus, we're not sure, because they're not comparable. And this is we got to find more material.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things is we don't have any sauropods, which are so common up in Central Australia. Mm-hmm. They just didn't get down here. Now, that may be a fact that the difference in paleolatitude. We were inside the Antarctic Circle. Exactly how far, we're not sure, but we were definitely inside the Antarctic Circle, whereas Central Queensland was well into what passed then for the temperate zone. And looking in the Northern Hemisphere, the sauropods don't get that high. Mm-hmm. You don't get them in Alaska, for example. Even though you've got contemporaneous ones at lower latitude. Mm-hmm. So that could be the whole answer. Sauropods just didn't really like to get up where it was nippy.
Who would, really?
Oh, I don't know.
They had no UGG boots.
Yeah. Yes, well, I mean.
I put out a series of paintings that Peter Trussler has done of the various basal ornithopods that you've got. Mm-hmm. So just to give you an idea, the original painting is right there on the wall.
Oh wow.
That's one of the first ones that he ever did for us, although he did some mammals, but I think that's the first dinosaur he ever did.
Oh, it is. It's the first one.
Yeah.
And the reason it's posed as a corpse was he didn't know how to pose it initially, so he thought the easiest thing to do is just have it lying down dead, so that's why he painted it. That's why he chose that scene.
But, and he chose it in the way that it was found in the...
Yeah, it was as a reconstruction. Of how the holotype might have appeared in the process of becoming a fossil. I mean, it's at the edge of a billabong, about 5 meters wide, and he was very clever in trying to show the width of it by, you see a reflection of the trees on the other side, mm-hmm. and yet, because if he tried to just show the whole width of the billabong, the dinosaur would have just been a blip.
Yeah.
But if you get up close and personal with it, you'll find out that there's all kinds of interesting things in it. Like, for instance, there's a lungfish tooth. The detail, the grain size of the sand is exactly the way it is, and we have indications that there was ice, and so he's done ice on the, and he's done it, I can't remember what time of the day and what time of the year, but he did it for a particular autumn. But
he had a problem with the ice because he wasn't familiar with it, so he froze water in his wife's freezer.
Freezer too.
Yeah. Well, he always made sure, he was mentioning it was Gail's.
It was freezer. Gail's freezer. Yes.
She was very tolerant.
You'd have to be.
So he just to know it, because he wasn't familiar with it.
No, that's right.
And
but it was also meant to be in autumn, but also at one time, particular time of the day. So he's, you know, the reflection, et cetera, is that he takes those things into account when he makes a painting.
That's an amazing painting. I've seen the image before, and I didn't realize that it was a painting.
No, yeah. No.
One of that's the privileges awesome. Has been working with Peter Trussler,
absolutely.
The artist.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Because I went out to find an artist because I had a composite collection of a mammal called Diprotodon, the largest marsupial that ever lived. And I needed somebody to basically put it together and to do a composite, because we're talking 1980. And so how do you find an artist? So we went to an art show, logical place. And I walked in and I saw this one painting of this bird that was about to fly off the canvas. I thought, that's the person I want. And so that began the association we've had with him now for 40 years.
Awesome.
And, It's been great. We've actually published a book called The Artist and the Scientist about how we work together, because there are books about paleo art, but this is a book that basically the way it's designed is that the first half of each episode, there's about 9 episodes discussed, 9 projects. In the first half, Pat or I set the scientific basis of what's done, and then he tells how he did it. So it complements each other. And we're very glad we're able to produce that book through Cambridge University Press.
Oh, that's
looking
a hefty
copy
book.
Now. Yeah. Wow.
I suppose to get all the paleo art in it, it's got to be a large book.
Anyway, yeah.
Speaking of collaborations, do you guys ever work together in the field or otherwise?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. All of this is joint.
Awesome. Yeah. Do you have a favorite story of working together or favorite
there's too
time?
Many. Look, we've been married for 53 years and we're still working together. That's a story.
Well, you've got one currently, the DinoQuest.
Yeah, DinoQuest is the exhibition that we have and we're traveling it. And it really is a showcase of the polar dinosaurs and how they, and you know, you ask your question, these dinosaurs are living in these extreme conditions. Why did they go extinct? What's the story? And that exhibition is the most interesting I think I've ever worked on, because what it does, it's interactive, but it's scientifically correct, and it brings kids and their parents as well and their grandparents into it and turns them into scientists. They get a little card and it's got some an unknown bone on it, and they have to go through the exhibition and they get more and more data as they go through it. And they also see docos of people digging up the bones and people being interviewed. They go into Dinosaur Cove and they get to explode things. They get to use a jackhammer.
And then we've got animatronics in it that Peter's art was used, and he was the advisor for making the animatronics of five of the characters in this story, plus, well, six of them, because Australovenator jumps out of the bushes at you and growls. coming into the exhibition, it's historically accurate. You come into a tent, and it's the tent of Ferguson that Tom was telling you about, who discovered the first bone, the first polar dinosaur bone in Australia in 1903. You come into his tent, that's where you get your card, but you also get the story behind the first discovery of a dinosaur ever in Australia. So the history is right, and then you go into this time tunnel, you go back in, and you also have some of the Precambrian, because what it does is it puts dinosaurs in their place. You have to understand where dinosaurs fit in the scheme of things. And then after you go through that little thing, and David Attenborough is there telling you about first life, etc., you go around the corner and you come into a dig site, then you go into another area which has got a prep lab. And the kids actually are given a rock, and they're sitting there, and they get to actually prepare the rock with people who are sitting there explaining to them what they're doing. Then you go into Peter's art studio, and you get to actually do some art. And then you see we've got a skeleton of a giant lizard called Megalania that Tom was responsible for putting together years ago. And Peter's art is then, it's the skeleton, a cast of it. And then Peter's art puts the muscles on it right in front of you. And then Peter's art puts the skin on it. And Peter is blah, 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 blah. He's telling you about it as all of this is going on. So then you go around the corner and you see a whole bunch of casts of the dinosaurs that were found and the mammals and all that. And then you go through another little corner and you come into Llewellyn's bedroom. And Llewellyn's bedroom is when she was about, you know, the age that he was telling you about. And there's a book that you can turn this. And Llewellyn is explaining to everybody as animated a person about how her dinosaur was discovered and how it was named and blah, 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 blah. And all through the exhibition, there's two characters that are
guides.
They're guides, but they are just in space. One of them is T-Rex, and the other one is Prof V. And he is T-Rex, and I'm Prof V. And then you come into the final thing. You've got your card. You put your card down on a viewer, and it pops up a printout of your dinosaur, the thing that you've been able to identify. Then you take that into this area where you've got some more people, blah, blah, blah. And you color it in, and you put it under another scanner, and it comes up on the screen and runs around.
Oh, yeah.
And then as you go out, there's some other activities, and you get a certificate as you leave. And also, there's some questions on the certificate. So now you've learned about the past. Let's look at the future. What do you think, after having understood why things went extinct and da-da-da-da-da and what the causes were, what do you think you can do to keep humans from going extinct? And it basically gives a lot of ideas about, you know, turn off the lights, don't use so much water. Doesn't say anything about population, but alludes to maybe two kids is a good idea. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of stuff in this that, one, makes you act as if you're a scientist, mm-hmm. and gives you the feeling that maybe you are able to make decisions about things. And then as you go out, there's playful things and such. But it's about, one, scientific accuracy, two, getting people to have the confidence that they can make decisions about things, and then doing something about it, which I really like. And we worked with the Singapore Science Center. We worked with a group called DigiMagic and another one called Design Format. And DigiMagic did all of the, all of the digital stuff that is part of it. Design Format designed a lot of the furniture, etc., in it. Mm. And it's a really good interactive thing, that the best one I've ever worked on. And they would have put all of those people. Our exhibition, our material is worth probably about $600,000 or $700,000, and Tom and I have accumulated that over, you know, a long time instead of owning a house. I mean, we've rented this house for 21 years, and we don't own a house or anything, but we've used our funds to put all this together. But these other people would have put in probably $1.5 to $2 million into making this exhibition what it is.
Wow.
And that's really why I'd like to travel it, because it generates funding for more research. And it also rewards those people who have put their heart and soul into making this as accurate an it's not just a dinosaur exhibition where you go in and the dinosaurs are roaring. They're roaring, all right. They're making noise. But what is in it has been well thought through. Mm-hmm. It's got scientific basis.
Yeah.
So we'll blah, blah, blah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So what's next for DinoQuest?
DinoQuest is in storage at the moment, and we're trying to, we've been working on a venue in Shanghai, which I hope we get. But we really would like to see it travel for the next 5 years. And so it's a matter of finding venues. And it would be great if it could travel to all the continents rather than just... Just staying in Southeast Asia. Yeah, we could take it to Antarctica. I think it'd do just fine at McMurdo.
Right. I'm sure they'd have a good roll-up.
A lot of penguins. Or maybe the odd seal.
Well, we did see penguins in Melbourne yesterday.
Yes. Yeah. Did you go down to...
We did.
Glad you got there.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Really good.
That was so great. And then there were the I think they're volunteers that are there, and they could shine a light and kind of tell you about what they're seeing. And yeah, it was amazing.
Oh, that's good. I wish you had time to go to our dig in November. It would be really good.
That would be cool.
Yeah. Are there any other projects you'd want to talk about?
One of the projects that we haven't talked about is Prime Sci. So in 1993, I set up an institution called Prime Sci, which was basically for scientists to get in direct contact with kids and to have get in contact with the teachers, get in contact, have some effect on the curriculum, etc. And that is now based at Swinburne, and we have programs going on all over the world as well as here in Victoria and Australia. We bring in all the money other than there's a couple of salaries that we get a little bit of help with from Swinburne. And we've got space that's provided by Swinburne, and we're continuing to do that. I mean, it started out, and I built a building that was worth $5.2 million. We had that for some time at one of the universities. We got kicked out of that building in 2012, and it's now being used by the Sustainability Institute. And Swinburne took us on, which is fantastic, because we bring in close to $500,000 a year to support the programs, and we still get scientists in contact with teachers, but emphasizing primarily primary kids, because high school kids get a lot of input. Primary kids don't get so much of that. Mm-hmm. And we have programs, as I said, we have them all over Australia, but we also have them in Kenya, we have them in Namibia, we have them in Afghanistan, we have them in... Israel. They've got their good programs there. We've got them in Iran. We've got them in Saudi Arabia. We've got them in all kinds of places. And we have that's just been something that the scientists that are involved, along with the people who are coordinating all this, have put together, and it's going strong. So
that's amazing.
Yeah, no, it is. And the point I would make is it is really important to put time into primary kids and their teachers and the curriculum, because if you don't get them continuing with their native curiosity, by the time they get into those period called the teenage years, things may change a little bit, and then they, then they're faced. You lose a lot of kids that would have gone on and at least have some idea what science is about. Even if they don't go on in science after high school, they at least have it in their brain that they can make decisions about what the bloody politicians are saying, excuse me. And, make reasonable decisions on their own rather than depending upon Wikipedia or somebody else who often has good opinions. But you want people, individuals, making their own decisions about things. If you inspire that in young kids, don't make them feel like, their opinion is not worthwhile, and encourage that. I think it's worth the fight.
That's awesome.
It really is. So Prime Sci is something that I hope will continue long after I'm gone.
Cool.
Yeah.
It sounds, it's all over the world already, so.
Yeah, and it's self-supporting. I mean, it really is. We manage somehow.
That's great.
Yeah.
For our listeners, then, if they wanted to learn more about you and your work or your projects that are happening or ongoing, where would the best place be for them to go?
Probably to us, but also Prime Sci is a good connection for teachers and for students, not only primary students, but high school students as well. Tom's Museum would be another place. The Science Center in Singapore, beautiful place to get in touch with and get into their programs, quite frankly.
Awesome.
So those are contacts.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us this afternoon.
Thanks for asking the questions and coming out and seeing us.
Thanks again, Tom and Pat, for the awesome interview and also for the gifts. They gave us some books and lots of...
wonderful materials, yeah.
It was really cool. And after we spoke to Tom and Pat, we made it over to the Melbourne Museum and got to look in the collections and see all sorts of amazing stuff, some of which has already been published on since we've been there.
And a lot of it was stuff that they had told us about, that they had found.
Yeah, like the really cool new Megaraptorid, which is Australovenator-like. And we also saw one of the feathers that ended up getting published here. And there was also a little microscopic flea, not microscopic, fossilized flea, which is a little tiny thing. It's really cool. They have quite a collection and it's growing all the time there.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to see the Dinosaur Dreaming Project, Tom sent us a PDF of it, which will be in our show notes on our website. So you can go to our website and you can get a copy of that there. We'll also have a link to some of the other things we talked about, including the video of the Melbourne Museum. So if you're interested in any of that, then head over to our longer show notes, which are on inodino.com. This episode is brought to you by Rosetta Stone, How Languages Learned. We're very fortunate that we've been able to go on many trips together and see tons of dinosaur museums and sites all over the world. Over the years, we've been drawn to dinosaur museums that are pretty far off the beaten path and not typically where a lot of tourists end up.
Unless you're a dinosaur enthusiast. One of our favorites is the Kita Kyushu Museum of Natural History and Human History in Japan. They have a time traveling room, which reenacts the end of the world for the dinosaurs at the end of the Cretaceous, complete with a gorgeous but haunting, extremely long-necked animatronic Mementosaurus. Knowing just a little bit of kanji made it so much easier for us to get to the museum and to even make it to that amazing time traveling room. It's kind of tucked away. Next time we go to Japan, we'll want to learn and practice our Japanese even more.
Yeah, and Rosetta Stone is a great way to brush up on languages before traveling. Their lessons are immersive, and it's designed to teach you to pick up new languages in a natural way. The lessons are short, about 10 minutes, so you can get them done at any time, even right after listening to a podcast, for example.
Wink, wink.
The best part is you can join now at rosettastone.com/dino, and you'll get a lifetime membership with access to 25 language courses at over 50% off. It's worth $399, but you can get it for just $179, and that's a reduction from last week. They just dropped it for our listeners even more. Again, that's rosettastone.com/dino.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And now on to our dinosaur of the day, Melanorosaurus, which was a request from Dinosaur4602, so thanks. Melanorosaurus was a sauropodomorph that lived in the late Triassic in what is now South Africa in the Elliot Formation. It was probably herbivorous. It had 4 teeth on each side of the premaxilla and 19 teeth on each side of its maxilla. It was quadrupedal and it had sturdy limbs like a sauropod and a large body. It was estimated to be about 26 feet or 8 meters long and weigh 1.3 tons.
Not too big for a sauropod, but I guess we're in the Triassic.
And it's a sauropodomorph.
Oh, true.
Melanorosaurus was probably a facultative biped, and that means that it could walk or run on two legs, but normally it used four. So we're saying it was mostly quadrupedal. It had a somewhat pointed snout and a triangular skull. The type species is Melanorosaurus redeye, and it was found on the north slope of the Thabanyama Black Mountain in Eastern Cape and Free State provinces in South Africa. The genus name means Black Mountain Lizard, and it was described in 1924 by Sidney Houghton. There used to be a second species, Melanorosaurus thabensis, named in 1993 by Francois Xavier Goff, based on a femur found in the Elliot Formation of Lesotho in 1959. But in 2016, a study found that the femur and other bones were actually a new type of dinosaur, Myroctenos thabanensis. There's also a synonym for Melanorosaurus, Rocosaurus tetrascralis, that was named in 1984 by Van Heerden and others, but now that's considered to be a nomen nudum. There's not too much information on it. In 1924, Houghton wrote that, quote, the bones consist of a tibia, a fibula, part of the pelvis, some vertebrae and metatarsals, together with a femur lying partly embedded in the overlying sandstone and the proximal half of a humerus found weathered down the slope. They are in the collection of the South African Museum, end quote. In 1979, Van Heerden analyzed this type material and assigned most of it to Euskelosaurus, except for a sacral tibia and femur. In 1997, Van Heerden and Peter Galton referred another specimen to Melanorosaurus redi based on the femurs being similar. In 2005, Galton, Van Heerden, and Yates said that many additional bones, mostly of Plateosaurus, were assigned to Melanorosaurus since 1924. They also referred a new specimen to Melanorosaurus redi and said the dinosaur was a, quote, Sauropodomorpha incertus sedis, pending further analysis of the holotype and of all the referred specimens, end quote. And that basically means they don't know where it fits in the family tree. In 2007, Yates revised the diagnosis of some of the specimens, but not the type specimens. There were two, and this is known as the syntype. Yates also described a referred skull. So there's some uncertainty around Melanorosaurus now, since the syntype specimens haven't been studied in a while, and they should be re-examined to identify diagnostic unique features. And the way scientists think of Melanorosaurus now is based on the referred specimens. Yeah, but some of the referred specimens are indirectly referred. They're referred based on a referred specimen.
Oh my God.
So it seems that Melanorosaurus in general needs to be re-examined. The syntype, both specimens are housed in Cape Town, and the referred specimens are stored at the National Museum of Bloemfontein in South Africa.
Well, at least they're all in South Africa.
Yeah.
Makes them a little easier to study.
That's true, but there's many things to study.
And our fun fact of the day is that Benjamin Keir, Tom Rich, and Patricia Vickers Rich, as well as some others, described the first identifiable dinosaurs found in Saudi Arabia. So Keir was also on the Polar Dinosaurs Feathers paper, which is why I mentioned him here, as well as obviously Tom and Pat, who've done like a majority of the work done in Australian paleontology, at least in Victoria for sure. This first discovery in Saudi Arabia was published just 7 years ago, and it was really easy to verify since the title of the paper is literally, quote, First Dinosaurs from Saudi Arabia, end quote.
That's a good title.
Yeah.
Tells you exactly what to expect.
Yeah, I just stumbled on it when I was looking for some other stuff, and I was like, oh, this would be a good fun fact. It's in PLOS One, which makes it open access, so you can see these very first described dinosaur material from Saudi Arabia. The way they put it is that it's the first identifiable dinosaurs because there's other stuff that might be dinosaur material, but it's just so weathered that you can't really tell for sure, even if it is a dinosaur. And if it is a dinosaur, what even broad group it might fit in. But this paper included several identifiable fragments, including titanosaur tail vertebrae and probable allosaurid teeth. And they all come from the Adapha Formation, which is from about 75 million years ago. And at the time, it would have been very close to the equator and still connected to Africa. So we expect that the Saudi Arabia ecosystem and dinosaurs would have been pretty similar to what we find in the rest of Northern Africa. Maybe not Southern Africa, because we've talked before about how some of them are pretty different in Southern Africa versus Northern Africa. But if we can find more dinosaurs in Saudi Arabia, it can really help us fill out some of this Gondwana details that we've been missing.
Can never have too many dinosaurs.
Yeah. I think Tom referred to Saudi Arabia as tantalizing in one interview.
Well, hopefully we get more paleontology in that area in the nearish future.
That would be great.
And that wraps up our first regular episode of 2020. I say regular because our first episode of 2020 was a best of 2019 episode.
True.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss out on any new episodes. And don't forget to join our growing community, patreon.com/inodino. Thanks again, and until next time.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.